It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some college basketball players will be allowed to hire agents, and underclassmen who enter the NBA draft but go unpicked can return to college. We'll hear about policy changes announced this week by the NCAA. First, Vice President Mike Pence announced yesterday that the long-rumored Space Force that President Trump and his administration have championed in the past will become a reality. At a news conference yesterday, Pence said that the Space Force was needed in order for the United States to maintain its space dominance and safeguard the country.
The space environment has fundamentally changed in the last generation. What was once peaceful and uncontested is now crowded and adversarial. Today, other nations are seeking to disrupt our space-based systems and challenge American supremacy in space as never before.
Not everyone has been on board with the plan, even within the Trump administration, and questions remain about how the agency would be run, implemented, and used in future efforts. Sandra Irwin writes about military space programs, policy, technology, and the industry that supports this sector for Space News. Sandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you briefly outline what the Trump administration is calling for here?
Yes. We heard from the Vice President, Mike Pence, yesterday what is being characterized as the first step towards the creation of a new branch of the military called the Space Force. What Vice President Pence did yesterday was he rolled out a report that shows a number of initiatives that the Department of Defense will be moving forward with in the next few years, with the expectation that there will be a separate service. But a lot of things have to happen before a fully independent service can be stood up. First, they have to work with Congress. There has to be legislation. There has to be a lot of moving pieces of the puzzle that have to be rearranged. And so I would say that, you know, this is the first step, but it was definitely a clear message to the country that the Trump administration is very serious about the Space Force, and they're not going to just let it get bogged down in bureaucratic negotiations and things like that, which is what a lot of times happens when you do major reorganizations in the government.
As presented by the Vice President, would anything new on a practical level actually be happening, or is this kind of just drawing a new organizational chart with a different line coming from the Pentagon to these space operations, that some of which we're already doing?
Yeah. No, I mean, everything that the military already is doing to defend satellites and to potentially counter any attacks from adversaries, that's not going to change. The Air Force has been doing that. They're going to continue to do that. So what we're going to see now is just a lot of internal reorganization and budgeting and figuring out who's going to be under whom in what agency. For example, some of the steps that the Vice President announced yesterday, one is to create a 4-star space command. Right now, the Air Force has a space command, but we don't have a U.S. Space Command with a 4-star general in charge, and that's one of the things that we're going to see happening probably in the next few months with congressional authorization. And then the other thing he wants to do, he announced yesterday, was a space operations force, which would be kind of like Special Operations Command, but focused on space. So that would be done so that the military can beef up its capabilities and skills in space, build up the expertise. The third thing is a space development agency, which would be focused on technology, on innovation, trying to bring in new technologies from the commercial sector and try to expedite the development of procurement, which has been a real problem in the Department of Defense. So these are things that are going to be happening in the near term, but the actual new service called the Space Force, we can anticipate it would be at least 2 years before that can be put into law. It's a very complicated process to create a new service. Most of us don't remember. We were not around when the Air Force was created in 1947, but that was a very, very arduous and lengthy process. And so it just doesn't happen overnight, and I think that's what's going to happen with the Space Force. And, of course, you know, the political environment also has come into play, because we have a midterm election coming up, and this is going to require funding. And if Democrats win the House, there's some speculation on the Hill that they are not going to want to fund the Space Force just because they will want to deny President Trump that victory, so to speak.
There had been reports of opposition to this idea from within the military. Even the Secretary of Defense had reservations about it. What were some of the reasons that people wouldn't want this change?
Well, there were several reasons. I mean, the military believes that they are doing a good job overseeing space, building capabilities, defending our assets. I mean, they are doing a good job. So they're actually, you know, initially the thinking was, why are we trying to fix something that's not broken? But Congress, especially in the House Armed Services Committee, they did not agree with that. They believe that the Air Force is overly focused on aviation and airplanes, not space. So there's been a lot of back and forth, and the Department of Defense was fighting legislation last year to pass that was going to create a space corps. So the Department of Defense fought back that legislation. It did not pass, but they have been very resistant to this type of change. They don't believe it's necessary. They think it's going to be costly, that it's going to be a distraction. And, you know, the commander-in-chief said, you have to do it. So now they're following orders and they're doing it.
Talking to Sandra Irwin from Space News about plans from the Trump administration for a unified command for military efforts in space. Sandra, can you talk about what kind of military threats there are in space is maybe a strong word, in Earth's orbit?
Based on public information, publicly available information, because I have to caveat that a lot of these threat information is classified and I'm not aware of it, but we were told by senior officials who have seen all the classified intelligence that there are space weapons being developed by China and by Russia, and that would be a mix of kinetic weapons, which would be like missiles that would be targeted at satellites, and also electronic weapons that would be like jammers that would disrupt satellite signals, and hacking tools that could be used also to hack into communication systems that are space-based. So there's a number of threats. Some of them, I know some of the think tanks in Washington, CSIS, the Secure World Foundation, they have put out studies that have very detailed information about unclassified threats that they have identified that are out there. So there's definitely threats out there, and that is a very real thing. The question is that people are debating is, you know, why do we have to have a separate branch of the military? Why can't we do this maybe with the Air Force or something, you know, in a different way that it's not so disruptive? But again, the argument from the administration is that the United States has neglected national security in space, and now it's time to step it up.
Are there international treaties or agreements on the militarization of space that cover missile weapons, cyber weapons, or even missiles that are ultimately bound for Earth that would travel through orbit first?
Yeah, there's an outer space treaty from the 1970s that is still in place, is still being followed. But over 40 years ago, so it's questionable, you know, whether there's a need for a new treaty and some new rules. They call them rules of the road in space. Even the U.S. military has said we have to have more clear rules of the road for engagement for activities in space, because there's just so much activity now, both military and commercial. So there is a treaty, but it's not necessarily all that helpful at this point. And the United States, and definitely the Trump administration, has argued that Russia and China are moving ahead developing anti-satellite weapons, and they're not going to be concerned about any treaties or any norms as long as, you know, they just want to be dominant in space. They want to possibly deny the United States the ability to use military satellites in military operations. So that would be, you know, for the military, that would be an extremely serious concern that they would not want to take any chances.
We'll leave it there for now. Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sandra Irwin writes about military, space programs, policy, and technology at Space News. She joined us today to talk about the newly proposed Space Force and what it can mean for the U.S. military. Coming up, as the FBI's probe into crooked recruiting practices continues, the college basketball rulebook is getting a makeover. We'll talk about the changes and what they mean. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Food Friday, you can't have summer in Wisconsin without sweet corn. Now that it's showing up at farmers markets and elsewhere, we'll get some ideas on what to do with it on and off the cob. Right now, some big changes to the college basketball rulebook are on the way. The NCAA announced on Wednesday that players considered elite can hire agents. And for underclassmen who enter the NBA draft but wind up going unselected, they can return to school. Those changes and others are the first in men's Division I basketball since the launch of an FBI probe into crooked recruiting practices. The agency has been looking into allegations that coaches took tens of thousands of dollars to set up players with financial advisors and agents. Arizona, Southern Cal, Oklahoma State, Louisville, and Maryland are some of the schools implicated so far. A commission led by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was created to address the problems. In April, she announced several recommendations to clean up the sport.
College basketball is too precious, and the fate of the young men who play it is too important not to get it right. And though this work will not be easy, we need to make a start, and a bold one, to turn the ship in the right direction. For the good of all involved, we need to put the college back in college basketball.
Dan Wolkin is a national columnist at USA Today. He focuses primarily on college basketball and football. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on the surface, it looks like a lot of new rules, maybe a big deal. Are people seeing this as a significant effort to tackle the problems uncovered by the FBI?
No, not really. No, people who are deeply involved in the sport, I think, look at the changes and the new rules is a bit cosmetic. The truth is that a lot of the issues that were discovered with this FBI investigation and a lot of the corruption that we all know happens in college basketball, none of these new rules did anything that will directly address those issues. Now, the ideas that were put into place were not terrible ideas. They were productive. I think there were some common sense changes that probably should have been done years ago. But in terms of cleaning up college basketball, I don't really think that anything they did will have a dramatic impact.
We'll dig into those changes in a minute, but remind us, this was a big story. There were arrests. Remind us of what the FBI was uncovering.
Well, the FBI basically, as part of a different investigation where somebody had been accused of financial crimes, they essentially gave the FBI a tip that there were these sorts of deals going down in college basketball that weren't being reported, a lot of under-the-table money, bribery, that kind of thing. And so they put together a sting operation last year where they were able to record coaches talking about financial benefits to secure players run through shoe companies. So that was really the gist of it. And then you had some assistant coaches who were getting kickbacks if they were setting players up with specific financial advisors. So it was a lot of sort of dirty deals and the kinds of things that happen all too often in college basketball, but I'm not really totally sure why the NCAA thinks that they're going to fix it by doing what they did this week.
Yeah, talk about what you see as some of the biggest changes that came out this week. You say these are not bad changes. Maybe they're just a little tangential to the main problem.
Well, the biggest change actually has to do with their enforcement division. The NCAA, they've got this, they call it enforcement. It's essentially a team of investigators, and they go out and try to uncover schools and coaches who are cheating. And this body of people has always had some limitations on it. They don't have subpoena power. They can't really compel people who are outside the NCAA to talk to them, and they have limits on the kind of information they can acquire from outside. So it's always been a bit of a difficult process to catch cheaters. And the biggest change this week is the NCAA really gave this group a more expanded power. And it's a little bit in the weeds. It's a little bit kind of, I think, boring maybe for people who don't, you know, get who aren't into this stuff every day. But these investigators can now use proceedings, legal proceedings, results of investigations by a body like the FBI, bankruptcy court, all kinds of things where violations may be uncovered. The NCAA can now use that information without doing their own investigation. And they also created this task force for the bigger cases, the more complex cases that include independent investigators, real investigators, not just the people in-house at the NCAA. So they gave themselves some new investigative powers, and that may make a difference. But ultimately, cheating in college sports has always been a cost-benefit analysis, and the NCAA is not going to catch most of the cheaters. The numbers are just not there, and the power they have is so small that they can't catch everyone. And yet, if you do cheat and that helps you win, as a coach, you stand to make millions and millions of dollars. So a lot of people will take that chance thinking they're not going to get caught.
Now, one of the changes getting a lot of attention is this idea of allowing so-called elite players coming into schools to hire agents. How does that work?
Well, a lot of this is tied to the NBA getting rid of the so-called one-and-done rule. The one-and-done rule was put into place about 10 years ago where no longer could high school basketball players go directly to the NBA draft, so they had to go to college for a year. Well, it looks like the NBA, which is under a lot of pressure to change this rule, is going to get rid of it. We're going to have high school players back in the NBA draft in about 2021, 2022, like somewhere in there. And so a group of players designated as elite, the details of how you get that designation still haven't really been sorted out yet, but they will be able to engage with agents that purportedly will help them determine whether or not they should be going into the draft or going into college. And then once they get to college, the relationship has to be terminated. So it's a little bit of a misleading headline, I think, to say that they're now going to be able to have agents, because the NCAA is not going to let them have a financial relationship. The agent is not going to be able to do things agents typically do, like lend money to prospects that they want to sign. So it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's not a bad thing. It's maybe a small step in the right direction, but it's not really as big and bold as they are making it look like.
Talking to Dan Wolkin with USA Today, looking at new changes in NCAA basketball after last year's FBI investigation and arrests, and a panel led by Condoleezza Rice looking at recommendations for reform. One thing these new rules don't address but came up in that Rice committee report was compensation of basketball players. What did that committee suggest, and why don't the new rules touch it yet?
Well, you know, the committee that looked into this didn't really they didn't really go as far as to say that athletes should be able to profit off their name, image, and likeness. And that's been a big debate for quite a long time in the college sports world. Is a lot of people believe, me included, that a lot of the issues and the cheating and the corruption would be fixed, or would at least be off the table, if you allowed people who are in college to go out and if they want to get a if Subway or Coca-Cola or McDonald's or whatever big company wants to give them a national marketing deal, or if a local car dealership wants to bring them out to sign autographs for 2 hours and pay them $1,000, that you would be allowed to do that. The rules say you can't, and colleges and university presidents have shown no interest in changing that, and the committee didn't really take that up as a solution. But I think it would be a solution. It's just too radical right now for the NCAA to touch.
What isn't in this new set of rules that you think would really, in a more head-on way, take on the problems revealed by the FBI?
Well, I mean, look, one thing they've done is they say they're going to increase penalties. So if you get caught cheating, you could potentially miss. You could potentially be banned from the sport for life. Your school could go on penalties for 5 years. I mean, you know, postseason bans. So there's a lot there that theoretically could dissuade people from going outside the rules. But realistically, you're always going to have some people who try to take shortcuts. I don't know that anything they did with the other rules, with the agent rules, being able to come back if you don't get drafted by the NBA, none of that stuff really will stop people from doing something that can make them money if the money's available to them. And as of right now, money's still available to them because talented basketball players have a market value above and beyond a scholarship.
Dan, from a fan perspective, does this taint on the NCAA basketball program? Does it hurt the game?
Well, I mean, look, I think anytime you have a major scandal in sports, people look at it and they want to know that what they're seeing is, is honest, fair competition. I think in college sports, most people who are big fans of college sports and of specific teams are educated enough about what happens to understand that cheating is in some ways part of the culture. And there's been a big shift on this, I think, in terms of the overall general public and their views on college sports. I mean, now opinion polls today versus 10 years ago show vastly different results in the number of people who believe college athletes should be compensated in some way. There's way more people now who are on board with that. And I think there's also been less of an appetite for the big scandals. I think people, read a story about a kid getting $1,000 or whatever, and they just sort of roll their eyes. It's not a pearl-clutching thing anymore.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Dan Wolkin, national columnist for USA Today. We talked about rule changes in the NCAA basketball program. Coming up next, it's Food Friday. It's sweet corn on and off the cob. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our candidate interviews ahead of next week's primaries. Today, we talk to Dr. Jennifer Vipond, running as a Republican in Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. First, Wisconsin is one of the leading sweet corn-producing states in the nation. According to the USDA, we harvested more than 54,000 acres last year and processed nearly 460,000 tons. Only Minnesota and Washington processed more. You might be seeing that fresh corn showing up at farmers markets, roadside stands, and grocery stores. Maybe you just like to boil it, slather it with butter, sprinkle it with salt, and eat it right off the cob. But it's pretty versatile. Our next guest even has a recipe for some corn ice cream. Terry Milligan is a chef and culinary instructor. She also writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section and the magazine Edible Door. She joins us now for Food Friday. Terry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
Well, sweet corn is an exciting time of year. I look forward to it. Do you, generally, year to year?
Well, I do. I'm originally from Indiana, so I was born kind of in a corn belt. So there, I now live in Wisconsin, but it's still it's my Indiana corn roots that I go back to. We just, loved sweet corn. Though I will say, when I was young, my mother never thought of making corn ice cream.
We'll get to that corn ice cream, but I want to go with the basics first. I mean, I'm a big fan of the simplest possible way. Boil it till it's ready, butter, salt, and you're good to go. Is there, as a basic method of making corn on the cob, that's not bad, right?
No, that's not bad at all. Not bad at all. Another good way, though, now, especially because it's the summertime, is not to forget that you can put corn, the corn on the grill, and you can grill them right in the husk. So you get even a kind of a smoky flavor on the corn, and that's kind of a fun way to enjoy a corn and also not to heat up your house during a warm day.
I'm a fan of that, and I learned, I think the hard way, I had some of the world's driest grilled corn, and I found the method of, peeling off some of the exterior stuff, but leaving some of the husk on, soaking it in a bucket or cooler of water for 20 minutes or so before it hits the grill. That keeps it nice and moist for me. Do you have any other advice for
that's
avoiding
exactly
that?
Exactly correct. That's a great way to do it. My only suggestion on that is to make sure you add a little salt to the water, too.
Okay.
Because then you're kind of flavoring the corn in the water as well, so you get a little bit more flavor in it. Another thing I do sometimes when, and in fact, I just did this the other day on the grill, I'm working on something for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and did this. I put fresh rosemary inside of the corn as it was on the grill. So inside the husks, you can put some fresh herbs in there, too, and you can kind of get some herby flavor as well.
Well, that sounds really good. Now, with that salt in the bucket, you said a little. I mean, how much does it take
I'd
to make
for
a difference?
About 12 ears of corn, you want to put them in a roasting pan that's pretty low so that you can submerge them. Sometimes I have to put a little weight down on top of them so they don't pop up. But about a generous teaspoon of salt for about 12 ears of corn. Not overly salted, but just a little bit so you get some salt flavor. It's kind of like making pasta. You want to put a little salt in the water to give it some flavor.
But you're not brining it.
No. And it's not going, as you said, for a long time. You know, a half an hour, 20 minutes, a half an hour, just to kind of get the as you said, so it doesn't come out dry. It kind of steams it then, you know, inside the husk.
Did I see you had a method for grilling that involved taking the husk off and rubbing it in olive oil?
You can do that as well. Mm-hmm. You can take the husk off and put it right on the grill if you want, but that could get a little dry if it's not the freshest corn. But you could also butter it or put olive oil on it and, again, wrap it back up after it's been in your water bath. So just to kind of give it some more flavor ahead of time that way, too. And you can flavor your butters as well. So you can put chipotle powder in there. You can kind of like the Mexican corn where they put lots of different flavorings on the corn.
We're cooking with sweet corn. Terry Milligan is with us on Food Friday. Okay, now I've just in the last couple of years started to get more creative with corn off the cob, Terry. We're going to talk about a few different ways to work with that. But first, you've got some advice on the best ways to get that corn off the cob and make the most use out of it. Talk us through that.
Well, the first thing you need to do is make sure you can get tools, but not everybody has all these little gadgets from stores. You know, they didn't always have those. So have a sharp knife. And it doesn't have to be a big chef knife. It could be a sharp paring knife, but it does need to be sharp. The other thing is you want to have a pretty steady hand in doing it. So in doing that, what I like to do is kind of cut the corn cob in half so that the bottom of it will sit straight up but not wobble. You know, sometimes if you put it on there and it kind of wobbles, you lose your effect of getting the knife working correctly. And one of the kind of an odd way to do it, but it works, you get a bundt pan and you can put your corn husk or a corn cob right in the middle of where that hole is and it kind of secures it. Then you can take your knife and go all the way around and get all those corn cobs off or kernels off. They'll fall into your bundt pan. And if you're cooking maybe a soup, you also get all that corn kind of juice that comes with it. So you get all the flavors, but it all catches into that bundt pan. So corn pieces are flying all over your kitchen.
When I read your thing about cutting the cob in half so you have two flat ends, I thought, why the heck didn't I think of that years ago? Because you're trying to, like, it's this oblong thing that won't stand up, and you're trying not to cut yourself while doing it. That just makes so much sense.
Not the easiest thing to balance, but sometimes, you know, the easiest, the most logical step is the last thing that comes to our mind.
Well, to my mind, anyway. Now, you mentioned soup, Terry, and that's one of the recipes you've shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday, a chipotle corn soup that looks fantastic. Talk us through that.
Well, what's great about this is you're also using the corn husks to make your stock, and people, again, don't think about using that. You have your stock. After you get that corn, fresh corn off your husks, you're going to throw those cobs right into your stock before you make the soup. Just stock with the corn cobs, and then you're going to simmer it for about 20, 30 minutes, and you get more corn flavor then because you're getting all the corn flavor off those broken cobs. Then you strain it, and you make your soup. Another nice thing about the soup that's on my website and on yours is that there's no flour in it. It's made with Yukon Gold potatoes as well as the corn. It's pureed, and when it's pureed, the potatoes make it thick. So you don't have any flour at all, so it's great for somebody who's looking for something that's gluten-free.
It looks really good. One thing I've done some, if I'm making soup or sometimes trying to do salsa with corn in it, is I'll toss the corn in some olive oil and roast it. And that roasting just adds a whole new level of flavor.
It really does. And if you have a cast iron skillet, it works really well because that retains a lot of heat. And then you get a really even smoky kind of flavor and little brown piece, you know, coloring on your corn.
Now, we've got another recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is using our grilled corn now, the corn we grilled a little while ago. Grilled corn and avocado salad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell us about that one.
That's a great one because you're going to get that grilled corn flavor, and you're going to get some nice flavor from the avocado. I'm pulling it down so I make sure I tell you correctly. And some nice coloring with some roasted red bell peppers in there and some nice sun-dried tomatoes that go in for another batch of flavor. It's a great little salad that you can use as an accompaniment with everything from a grilled steak to chicken to salmon or just alone. But I really like to use it in the summertime as an accompaniment with a grilled item, a grilled protein.
Now here's a question I have for you. In the winter, if I'm making soup, I keep some frozen corn around. It's an easy thing to throw and add a different, you know, level of flavor and texture to a soup. Am I going to be any better off if I take that roadside corn now, cut it off, freeze it, put it in the freezer? Is that going to be any different than the stuff I just buy frozen in the store?
Oh, it is. It's going to be the origin of your corn when you do that. And you know that it was fresh when you put it in. I'm sure that it's fine to get frozen corn, but you're not going to get that flavor of having picked it up at the farm stand and putting it on right into your freezer like that. So it definitely will have more flavor. And you also get a little bit more of a fresher corn because it's right off. You're taking it right off, and it has more of the corn. I guess it would be juice, but corn water juice liquid in there. So it'll be much fresher. My mom used to, in Indiana, she'd have a week where she'd just do corn for the freezer. And we'd have it all winter long.
Ooh, that sounds great. We're talking to chef and culinary instructor Terry Milligan about what we can do with sweet corn. Maybe you like to eat it straight off the cob with just butter and salt. No problem there. But Terry says we can do a lot more. Soups, salads, and even, we'll talk about this, ice cream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're eating corn on the cob, do you prefer boiled or grilled? And do you have any tips for how to make the most of it, whether you're boiling it or grilling it? And do you cook with fresh corn? If so, how? Do you have soups, salads, desserts that it ends up in? Got any tips, tricks, or questions for Terry about preparing it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We've got a few recipes from Terry, corn recipes, on the Ideas Network Facebook page and at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Terry Milligan about the things we can do with sweet corn. She's a chef and culinary instructor. You can read her work in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section and in the magazine Edible Door, like as in Door County. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to prepare and or eat sweet corn? Where do you get it? Farmer's market, road stand, grocery store, backyard? Do you have a recipe you like to use? Do you need some advice? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Karen is with us in Woodruff. Karen, hi.
Hi. The best place to get corn is from the corn man up in Ashland, Wisconsin. That is the sweetest, tenderest corn in the whole wide world. But what I do with a cob of corn is I put the cob, everything, husks and all, in the microwave for about 2 minutes. Turn it over, and if it's a smaller cob, then only for a minute and a half again, and if it's a regular size cob, then for another 2 minutes. And then what you do is take the stalk end, and you cut maybe about a half inch or an inch off that end of the cob, and then you squeeze on the silk end, and all the silk stays inside the husks, and you get this nice cob of corn out.
And it's ready to eat after cooking that long in the microwave, Karen?
And it's ready to go. And then you butter it and sprinkle on some Parmesan cheese.
Mm-hmm. Karen, thanks a lot for the call. I've heard of that. I've never done it, Terry, but microwaving your corn.
I have microwaved corn, but I must say I never did it with the husks on, so I'll have to try that. I've just put plastic wrap on it. But I think that the corn husk would be a much more natural way.
Yeah, why not?
So I'm going to try that.
Karen, thanks a lot for the idea. We'll go next to Gloria in Milwaukee. Gloria, hi.
Hi, am I supposed to talk?
Yep, it's your turn, Gloria. What did you want to tell us about?
I'm sorry.
That's
okay. I thought you were recording before. Okay, as I said, one of my favorite things to do with corn being in season is to take corn, cut it off the cob raw, and add it to, generously add it to pancake mix. Pancakes cook long enough to cook the corn. It makes marvelous corn fritters. Every time you take a bite, you get this little burst of flavor, and that's that. And as long as I'm being on the air again, when I cook corn in the microwave, I haven't ever tried it with the husks on it, but I wrap it in a wet paper towel, and it cooks nicely.
Gloria, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, corn in the pancakes, corn kernels in baking, I imagine, might be good too, Terry.
It is. I just did actually a kids' cooking class just recently, and we had one day we did corn. It was a whole week session, and we did blueberry cobbler, and the cobbler topping had corn in it, had cornmeal, but also actual corn kernels in it. So they got I had a little different way to use the corn.
Love it. Thanks a lot for the call, Gloria. We heard from Chris on Facebook. Chris says, haven't tried this yet, but a guy gave me this hint at the grocery store. Shuck, soak in water, okay, wrap in bacon, cook on the wood grill. So bacon, I mean, a lot of people like to wrap anything in bacon. This sounds like
exactly. What's not good cooked in bacon? But I guess that would work well. I would be a little, I wonder how he kind of secures it on there to make sure the bacon stays on there, and you'd have to kind of watch it, some flame, maybe. But I bet it makes a good mean corn with that on there.
Yeah, you don't want it just to fall into the grill, though, and just have
bacon
smoked corn.
Bacon, you know, especially if it's like a Nisky bacon, you don't want to lose that.
Yeah, definitely. we'll go back to our callers. Matt is with us in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have two very simple ones. The first one's kind of goofy. Everybody might not like it, but I was working at a organic CSA farm and learned that you can just eat corn right off the plant, and I ate 12 ears, 12 cobs that day, and it's very sweet, juicy, fresh right off the stalk. But if people aren't into that, they want to cook it. If you're camping and at the end of your campfire when the coals are getting kind of red, just lay it right on there in the husk and, like, have it just cook down and just have a late-night snack is one of my favorite ways to eat it for sure.
Fantastic, Matt. Thanks for that. And Matt reminds me, I mean, eating it raw off the stock doesn't sound so bad. I've done the thing where you just cut it off, don't cook it, and just mix it in with a salad or something.
Oh, exactly. I have to say, my husband is from Indiana, too, and one of his jobs as a kid was taking the tassels off of the corn in the field, and he would eat it right off the field, too.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about cooking with corn, sweet corn on and off the cob. Terry Milligan is with us, Wisconsin chef and cooking instructor. We'll get back to your calls in just a few moments. But, Terry, we promised some corn ice cream here. And, you know, the more I think about it, I've never had it. The more I think about it, I think it would work. Tell us about corn ice cream.
Well, it does work. And, you can say it, people do question it when they see this recipe, but it's pretty darn delicious. Just like the soup, you're going to flavor the milk and heavy cream that you use for the ice cream with the corn kernels. So you put the corn kernels, the corn cobs, milk cream, some nice fresh vanilla, and you bring it to a simmer, let it steep. You're going to take it off the heat, cover it, let it steep. And then you discard the cobs, but those kernels are still in there. And then you just puree the whole thing. And that's what you get for your kind of custard base for your ice cream. So you get all that nice corn flavor in there, plus the corn, again, from those cobs. And I like to serve it with a fresh berry sauce. Being from Door County, I like cherry sauce, of course. But the recipes that I have in the this issue of Edible Door has the corn ice cream with a fresh blueberry sauce as well.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bill is with us in Sheboygan County. Bill, hi.
Hello. Hey, thanks for the program. Nice. Well, giving credit where credit's due, I come from Illinois. So that means that I want to find good old yellow sweet corn. Everybody's going to this white super sweet. That's terrible. All right.
Bill, thanks a lot. Your line's a little dropping out there, but Bill doesn't mince words. The white too sweet corn is terrible, he says.
Well, you know, you talk to every person, they're all going to have a favorite sweet corn that they have or a favorite place, like the woman in Ashland who had a favorite spot to get corn, and that's the best place in the whole world.
How do you judge corn, Terry, when you're buying? Because I've seen the people that look at, they'll peel back each ear. I'll do that a little, but at some point I lose patience, and I'm like, I'll just take what they got.
Well, I do really feel it's wise to peel back a little because not every corn, it's nature, so not every corn is going to be beautiful, and you want to make sure you don't get some with little animal, you know, somebody got in there before you and took some of the corn kernels out. So I do like to give it a little look-see. I will say if I'm at a farmer's market, I'm less likely to do that because I know those are really, really fresh and they've just come off the farm. But if I'm in a store, I'm going to always check it out.
Bill, thanks for the call. We go next to Roger on the line in Grantsburg. Roger, hello.
Hey, how are you doing? Great
show. What'd you want to tell us about, Roger? Thanks.
Well, the gal called in there about microwaving it. 3 minutes. Leave the husk on. Don't peel it. Don't do nothing. Just like you go pick it up out of the truck. Put it in the microwave. 3 minutes. Cut the back end off. Peel all everything off, all that. I take and cut it off. I don't like chewing it off the cob. I'm kind of dentally impaired. So it's like, well, I cut it off. Mama was going to Walmart, and she was getting this bags of, like, the cheddar cheese and the nacho cheese, like, for dipping pretzels in. Well, I thought, cheese on corn. That sounds great.
Sure.
Two things in Wisconsin, corn and cheese.
Roger, thanks a lot.
Nacho cheese, huh?
Nacho cheese mixed in with that fresh microwaved corn, Terry.
Well, you know, it's like the Mexican version of corn where they have a lot of cheese and butter and kind of slather it on with lime. And I love lime on a corn, too, fresh lime juice with a lime butter. You know, flavoring the butters are great. I did one event once that had a corn bar on it. So you had all the corn ready to go, and we let all the guests pick what they wanted to put on the corn. So we had all these different toppings and different salts, sea salts, and you could really go crazy with what you wanted to do for your corn. So kind of a fun thing you could do for Labor Day is have a corn buffet.
Let's go to another caller. Roger, thanks for that. Karen is with us in Pewaukee. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because my husband and I own a restaurant in Brookfield, Wisconsin, Pewaukee, Wisconsin, called Jake's Restaurant, and we feature corn in all different ways in our menu this time of year. We have we do a fresh creamed corn, but then we add basil and Parmesan. We also do a sweet corn soup, and we actually make a corn stock by juicing the corn on the cob, and then we thicken it with cream and herbs. And then we also do a seared scallops, and scallops and corn are a great pairing. So if you just take the scallops and sear them in a cast iron skillet really quickly, and then serve them with the creamed corn, it's just a heavenly pairing.
That sounds all very good, Karen. Thank you so much for sharing that. Terry, in our last minute or so, talk about other things that go really well with corn. Seems like who's going to argue with corn? Nothing.
Well, it's true. Corn is produced in every continent of the world except Antarctica. So everybody in the world really uses corn. But some different things that you can do with it that we have posted, you might want to try making a risotto that has corn added to it. I've done the scallops with a risotto with the corn. And the one I have on my the website talks about a sweet corn and wild mushroom risotto. And then similar to baking with corn, you can make like a crab cake. Try a shrimp and sweet corn cake. So a little bit of a kind of a crab cake, but with the shrimp instead, and have that sweet corn in it. And you could do that as an appetizer or as a main course. So corn is extremely versatile, very versatile from, as you saw, appetizers to dessert.
Good place to leave it, Terry. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Well, I appreciate you calling me up. Thanks a lot.
Terry Milligan is a chef and culinary instructor. She writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the magazine Edible Door. We've been talking about sweet corn. You can still find her recipes for chipotle corn soup, grilled corn and avocado salad, and sweet corn ice cream with blueberry sauce at WPR.org/Food Friday or on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And while you're there, let us know how you like to cook and eat your corn and where you like to get it while you're there. If you've ever spent time at the Smithsonian Institution and one of its many museums, today is a special day. It's the Smithsonian's birthday. On this day in 1846, President James K. Polk signed the Smithsonian Institution Act into law. But the lead up to that was a little weird, as reported on the History Channel website. It all started with a scientist from England named James Smithson. Here's the story. He dies in the year 1829. In his will, he leaves his estate to his nephew, but he says as if his nephew dies without an heir, it all goes to the United States, quote, to found at Washington under the name of the Smithsonian Institution an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge, end quote. Now, this is even though this guy has never, ever been to the United States. Fast forward 6 years. Nephew dies, no heir. Congress votes to accept this random scientist's estate. What's in it? Well, his notes, his mineral samples, a lot of other sciencey stuff, and 11 boxes of money, coming to 104,960 gold sovereigns, 8 shillings and 7 pence. Melt down the gold in those sovereigns, you got $500,000, which was a lot of money in those days. And now they've got everything from, what, a space shuttle to Fonzie's jacket and more. Ultimately, they also got John Smithson, or at least his remains, too. So it all came full circle. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.